Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. Today we'll hear a talk by Joe Starita, a professor in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, former New York bureau chief at the Miami Herald, and author of The Dull Knives of Pine Ridge, A Lakota Odyssey, and I Am a Man, Chief Standing Bear's Journey for Justice. He'll speak on the topic Chief Standing Bear of the Ponca Indian Tribe. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 21st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Betty Davis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
Joe Starita will be telling the story of Standing Bear, the Ponca Indian chief whose trial in Omaha in 1879 resulted in a landmark decision that Indians must be treated as persons under the law. Joe Starita is an award-winning author, college professor, and former newsman. For a number of years before coming to Nebraska, he was investigative reporter and New York bureau chief for the Miami Herald, and a story of his was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now he is professor of journalism, where his innovative classes have won awards, as well as his books, and he is at the University of Nebraska's College of Journalism in Lincoln. He previously wrote The Dull Knives of Pine Ridge, telling the four generations of a Lakota Sioux family, and that won him a second Pulitzer nomination. The talk today is based on his book, I Am a Man, Chief Standing Bear's Journey for Justice, and it too has won several awards. Mr. Starita will talk for about 30 or 40 minutes. We'll open it up then for questions from the audience. Paper and pencil is on your table. Gary Kerr, the chairman of our committee, will bring those forward and I will read the question from the podium. Please write down your questions carefully and be sure to ask all that you wish. Welcome, please, with me, Joe Starita.
Before the crowd began to file out, the judge made an announcement. Although the trial now had officially ended and the legal proceedings were finished, one last speaker had asked permission to address the court. The judge supposed it was the first time in the nation's 103-year history that such a request had been made. But he had decided to grant it, and he had earlier informed all the lawyers of his intention to do so. So the crowd settled back down and turned its attention to the front of the court. They all saw him rise slowly from his seat, and they could see the eagle feather and the braided hair wrapped in otter fur, the bold blue shirt trimmed in red cloth, the blue flannel leggings and deerskin moccasins, the red and blue blanket, the Thomas Jefferson medallion, and the necklace of bear claws. When Standing Bear got to the front, he stopped and faced the audience for a long time, extending his right hand, holding it still. After a while, he turned to the bench, and he began to speak in a low voice, his words conveyed to the large crowd by the Omaha Indian poet Bright Eyes. "That hand is not the color of yours, but if I pierce it, I shall feel pain. If you pierce your hand, you also feel pain. The blood that will flow from mine will be of the same color as yours. I am a man. The same God made us both." Then Standing Bear turned and faced the audience, pausing for a moment, staring in silence outside a courtroom window, describing after a time what it was he saw when he looked outside that window. "I seem to stand on the bank of a river. My wife and little girl are beside me. In front, the river is wide and impassable. Standing Bear sees there are steep cliffs all around, the waters rapidly rising. In desperation, he scans the cliffs and finally spots a steep, rocky path to safety. "I turn to my wife and child with a shout, 'We are saved! We are saved! We will return to the swift-running water. Water that pours down between the green islands. There lie the graves of my fathers.' So they hurriedly climbed the path, getting closer and closer to safety. The waters rushing in behind them. But a man bars the passage. If he says that I cannot pass, then I cannot. The long struggle will have been in vain. My wife and child and I must return and sink beneath the floodwaters. But we are weak and faint and sick. I cannot fight no longer. Standing Bear stopped and turned, facing the judge, speaking softly. You are that man. In the crowded courtroom, no one spoke or moved for several moments. After a while, a few women could be heard crying in the back, and some of the people up closer could see that the grizzled frontier judge had temporarily lost his composure, and that the brigadier general, too, was leaning forward on the table, his hands covering his face. Soon some people began to clap, and a number of others started cheering, and then the general got up from his chair and went over and shook Standing Bear's hand, and before long a number of others had done the same. The bailiffs asked for order, and when it finally grew quiet again, the judge said he would take the case under advisement and issue his decision in a few days. And then he adjourned the court shortly after 10 o'clock on a warm Omaha spring evening on the 2nd of May, 1879. We need good stories. We need stories. We've always need stories. From the caves of Lascaux to the Iliad and the Odyssey to the parables of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John to William Shakespeare, to James Joyce, to Mark Twain and Huck Finn, and to the Old Man and the Sea. We have always needed stories. And I want to tell you a little bit this afternoon about this story. This is a hell of a good story. And it's a story that springs from the soil of our own state, a mere 125 miles north of here. And the reason I chose to start today's talk with that passage is that trial, which we just described, Standing Bear addressing the court, occurred directly across the street from where we are now. In May of 1879, the federal courthouse in Omaha was a monolithic limestone building at the corner of 15th and Dodge Streets, a space that's now occupied by the Doubletree. And on the second floor of that monolithic limestone courthouse, this magnificent story that had been building and building and building for 103 years, really, climaxed on the second floor across the street from where we're now eating. And those people who were in that courtroom, and that brigadier general who covered his face, and that grizzled frontier judge who didn't really like Indians and had to be pulled in from a grizzly bear hunting trip to hear this case, and all of the lawyers who were fascinated by it, clustered in this second floor courtroom across the street, saw something that no one had ever seen in the 103-year history of our country. They saw an American Indian, a middle-aged father, a chief of 750 Ponca people who had been forcibly removed, illegally removed, from their ancestral homeland, which they had not one but two Senate treaties verifying that they were the legal occupiers of that land. And now they saw before them this middle-aged chief of these 750 people, this devoted father who was merely trying to walk 550 miles in the dead of winter to honor a deathbed promise he had made to his only son to return this boy's remains to the Niobrara River homeland. And when these people looked out and saw him sitting at the front of the courtroom, that had never happened before in the history of our country. No American Indian had ever been granted access to a federal courtroom and had been allowed to sue the government of the United States for illegally detaining him and his people from their lawful right to try and honor this deathbed pledge that he had made to his 16-year-old son, who had died a few months earlier at the bottom of a dank army canvas tent in this hated homeland that they were forcibly removed to, called Oklahoma. And so this was a historic moment, and what I love about this story in many ways is it's an Omaha story. It is at the emotional, legal, spiritual center of this story It's an Omaha story. It's an Omaha story. And it's important for us to know these stories, whether they were scrawled in pictographs on the caves of Laskow or whether they sprang to life from Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. These stories, like Standing Bears and all the ones that precede them, are important cultural glue for us to know these stories, because these stories tell us who we were yesterday. And if we know who we were yesterday, that helps inform us as to who we are today and who we will be tomorrow. So I think we are very honored and very fortunate to have a story with this kind of narrative firepower and with this kind of moral and ethical and political and spiritual lessons to have sprung from our own soil, a completely true story. Wendell Berry, a Kentucky poet and one of my favorite writers, maybe that name resonates with some of you, once said, "If you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are." And if you let that concise, simple sentence roll around in your head long enough, you can see the power and the impact that spring out of those few words. If you don't know where you are, you don't know who you are. Is that true, do you think? Is that true of the neighborhood you live in? Is that true of the church you worship in? Is that true of the city and the state that you live in? Does place, does the geographical space that you occupy help determine in some way, shape, or form who you are? I think if you thought about that for a while, you would have to agree that it does. And of all the ethnologists in the last quarter of the 19th century who swept from the East Coast across the Great Plains of the United States and began looking into these tribes and their cultural values and their belief system, ethnologist after ethnologist concluded there was no tribe west of the Mississippi that they had studied that had sunk a deeper cultural taproot into their homeland than the Ponca people of Standing Bear. They had lived along the Niobrara River for more than 200 years, and they knew everything about their homeland. They knew how to bring this lush valley to life with corn and wheat and pumpkins and squash that helped save dozens and dozens of white families when they began spilling across the northern plains and experienced their first winters. They knew where the deepest holes were in the Niobrara to fish for the largest catfish. They knew every rock. They knew every tree. They knew every stone. Most importantly, they knew the seven sacred hills that surrounded them where they buried their dead. And so they had become one with this land. And when a strange white man appeared in the winter of January 1877, a man who knew nothing about Indians in general or the Ponca specifically, and said, "The Great White Father wants you to leave your homeland and move to the Indian Territory," which was a completely abstract term. There's no Ponca living along the Niobrara River beneath the shadow of these seven sacred hills, near their lush fields, near all of the cottonwood trees that they thought were religious symbols along the Missouri and Niobrara rivers. Nobody had any idea what it meant to move land that two Senate treaties said they legally occupied for a place that meant nothing to them, the Indian Territory, which in 1907 morphed into Oklahoma. Now, we know that no Nebraskan at any time is going to voluntarily move to Oklahoma. Now, then, and certainly Standing Bear and the Ponca had no intention of turning their backs on their dead. When Crazy Horse was once asked where his lands are, his simple reply was, "My lands are where my fathers lie buried." Standing Bear felt exactly the same way. The other 750 Ponca felt exactly the same way. But they ultimately, through being thrown in prison, by having their food rations withheld, by having the water withheld from the old people and the babies, they were eventually crushed, and with bayonets to their back, they were forced to move from their beloved homeland to what became Oklahoma. Do most of you know the narrative arc? I don't want to spend time going over the narrative arc if most of you already know the basic beginning, middle, and end of this story. How many of you would say that you really do not have a good grasp of the narrative arc of this story? Show of hands, do not, because it won't make sense. Okay, so about half. Well, just very concisely and very simply, the Ponca people who owned this land, according to two Senate treaties, who lived there for 200 years, who had sunk the deepest cultural taproot that any ethnologist could discover among the dozens of tribes west of the Mississippi, in the spring of 1877 were physically removed from this beloved homeland, and in a 55-day march of almost biblical proportions, snow, sleet, rain, cold, not one tornadoes, but two tornadoes. And finally, limping across the Kansas border into Oklahoma in July of 1877, searing heat, staggering humidity that these northern people could not deal with. They were unceremoniously dumped on the land within 1 year. 1 year of living in Oklahoma, a third of the tribe had died. 250 of these hardy northern people who had been thrown into these humid ravines in Oklahoma in these cheap army canvas tents that were swarming with mosquitoes. 250 of the Ponca people from Nebraska had died that first year. And on Christmas week of 1878, the chief's only son, a 16-year-old boy named Bear Shield, whom Standing Bear had invested the entire future of the Ponca people in this boy. He had sent him to schools to learn English. He had sent him to missionaries to learn about the white man's religion. He understood that in order for the Ponca to survive in this new world order, they would have to have one of their own know a good deal about the dominant majority. And this person was Bear Shield, who studied American history, who became proficient in English, who knew all about Christianity. But on Christmas of 1878, this 16-year-old boy, whom Standing Bear envisioned as the future of the tribe, was lying curled up in a fetal position in the bottom of one of these army canvas tents in the bottom of a creek in Oklahoma, dying of malaria. But before his eyes closed in death, he extracted a promise from his father, the chief, that upon his death, he would never, never bury the son's remains in this hated land called the Indian Territory, but would return them to the Niobrara homeland. So on the afternoon of January 2nd, 1879, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, Standing Bear dressed Bear Shield in his finest clothes, wrapped him in a buffalo robe, and put his body in the back of a rickety wagon, and he and 29 others snuck away from their reservation in Oklahoma, and they began walking north 550 miles into a fierce blizzard that was coming out of Canada. And on the day they left, January 2nd, 1879, the air temperature on the road up ahead that day was 19 below zero. Not wind chill, but straight air temperature. And I know this because there is a repository on the University of Nebraska campus that has all the weather records going back 150 years of the Great Plains states. And so this was a tremendous struggle for them to walk from Oklahoma trying to reach the Nebraska-South Dakota border. They would hollow out haystacks in the open fields of Kansas and stick the old people and the babies inside to keep them from freezing at night. They would rummage for field corn by day and boil this corn in open fields and survive on the field corn one day at a time, 1 week at a time. They got within 2 days of the beloved homeland and they were caught. And they were marched back to Fort Omaha. And ultimately, through all kinds of extraordinary, some intentional, some serendipitous, they all came together on the second floor of this courtroom across the street from where we sit now. And for the first time in the history of the United States, this grizzly bear hunting, Indian hating judge who was really moved by the humanity and the power of this man's story, declared for the first time in our history that an Indian must now be considered a person within the meaning of the law, within the meaning of the law. And that because Standing Bear, on the advice of his lawyers, had divorced himself from his official tribal affiliation, the judge further declared, for the first time in the 103-year history of our country, that Standing Bear was entitled to the same constitutional protection as the more fortunate white race, in the judge's words. So it was a magnificent story from the beginning. It's got everything in it. And there's so much that we can learn from this story, that we should have learned from this story, and hopeful that we still can learn from this story. And it all is unfolding under almost literally under our noses. I want to give you three very specific reasons why, in the 3 years that I spent researching and writing and rewriting this book, why I would routinely get out of bed at 3 o'clock in the morning, dead of winter, 8 inches of snow outside, two above, lay in that bed, think about that paragraph that I'd written 12 hours earlier. I knew it was an eighth of an octave off, and I wanted it to be Luciano Pavarotti. And so I would get up and put a pot of coffee on and go back to the computer and reread that paragraph that I'd written at 3 in the afternoon and try and figure out how I can tweak these words so that this paragraph will not be an eighth of an octave off. I owed it to him to do that. Why wouldn't I? This man walked 550 miles. All I had to do was turn up the heat, put on the coffee, and if I got tired, I could go to bed. So I would get up morning after morning after morning to try and rewrite and polish and smooth out everything I'd written that day, because I felt I was obligated to do that. When you go off on one of these three-year journeys, you have to have already settled in your mind a couple of things, or you will go insane when you try and condense this complicated story into 120,000 words and make it a page-turner. Make readers keep reading it. And if you can't do that, then you've wasted all the time. So the one thing you have to be sure of is that this is a good story. This is a good story. And you almost have to have a whiff of arrogance that not only is it a good story, but there's nobody who could tell it better than you. And if you don't have both of those things going for you, after about 6 weeks, you don't want to walk by an open window on the third floor of any building. You don't want to do that. So you want to have the deck stacked in your favor. One of the things that you have to evaluate when you start this three-year marathon, literary marathon, one way to evaluate if it's a good story and if it's going to be in your best interest to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning for a year and a half is, does this story, in its aboriginal state, in its pure state, does it have a number of universal themes? Does this story have a constellation of universal themes that you can braid together into a narrative quilt so somebody in Argentina can pick up that quilt, read this story, and identify with the protagonist, identify with the characters? Can somebody in Berlin identify with this man and what he's going through? Can somebody in Beijing understand the basic universal themes at play here? And if you say no, 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 and no, then you don't want to write this story. But if you can find, after careful research and analysis, that this is a story chock-a-block with universal themes, then you're not going to be afraid of that third story open window. We've been conditioned to believe in many of our educational systems and our educational history, if you want good universal themes, well, then you should go read Mr. William Shakespeare. You want to find good universal themes? You should go check out some of the literature of Mr. Fyodor Dostoevsky or maybe Mr. Ernest Hemingway. But I am here to universally and categorically tell you that you do not have to schlep across some dreary Scottish countryside. You don't have to trudge down some snowy, frozen street in St. Petersburg. You don't have to schlep across some bloody bull ring to find a story with good universal themes, because this is loaded with universal themes. This is a story at its essence about love of country, about love of homeland, about love of family. This is a story about courage, freedom, perseverance, and honor. And if those aren't enough universal themes for you to work with, then you should probably be a claims adjuster at State Farm. Not that there's anything wrong with being a claims adjuster at State Farm, but if you've got those universal themes to work with and you can't braid them into some narrative story, then you're not really meant to be a writer, or you're not meant to be writing. So that's one of three very specific reasons why I love this story. It has a tremendous power and a tremendous, very specific set of universal themes that everybody can identify with. Everybody, anywhere, if they've got a pulse and an IQ above 10, you can understand what Standing Bear was going through. what the mother white buffalo girl was going through when her baby six-month-old daughter on the third day of the march died of pneumonia in the middle of nowhere. Indian people never leave their dead behind, never. And there's no mother on earth who couldn't read those three pages about the burial of white buffalo girl on the highest hill in the Neely Cemetery overlooking the Elkhorn River and not just be chilled and knees trembling. It's that powerful of what happened at that moment at the Laurel Hill Cemetery. So there's no question that this is a book you can get up at 3 o'clock in the morning for, because it's got everything you need. The second thing that this book has, this story has, that I don't think anything else I've ever encountered, if you took the 19th century, the entire run of the 1800s in America, and you spread those 100 years out on a continuum, and you analyzed every single intersection on that 100-year continuum where the forces of manifest destiny collided with the indigenous people, an overwhelming, insane majority of the time, not a lot of good happened to the indigenous people when those forces collided. But what is so interesting about this story, and what is so deeply rooted in Omaha about this story, is this is one of the very few, if only significant, collisions between manifest destiny and the Native people in the 1800s, in which there were so many white heroes that came out of the woodwork at all levels of Nebraska and Omaha society to rally around Standing Bear's flagpole. And that had not happened at any other point in our history. What is it about this man that made the Brigadier General of the United States Army, a West Point graduate, the highest-ranking military man west of the Mississippi, disobey a direct order from his superior, Lieutenant General Philip Sheridan in Chicago, ordering George Crook to turn their faces south and march them right back from where they came, knowing that every one of these 30 Ponca would die en route? And Sheridan, of course, had famously said some years earlier that the only good Indian is a dead Indian, and he meant it. But George Crook, pacing back and forth in that beautiful house not far from here, late at night, in this tremendous battle between his military conscience and his civilian conscience, at some point late in March of 1879, late at night, that needle tilted ever so slightly towards his civilian conscience, and he couldn't pull the trigger on that command. What he did instead, he snuck out to the stable, he saddled up his horse, he rode under cover of darkness 3 miles south, and knocked on the door of the assistant editor for the Omaha Daily Herald, which would soon become the Omaha World Herald, and out walked Mr. Thomas Henry Tibbles, a freak show of a character. Couldn't make this guy up. And the Brigadier General of the United States says to the assistant editor of the local paper, "Tom, I think I've got a story you're going to be interested in." Now, I've been a journalist for 30 years. New York, Miami, all over the place. And for 30 years, I've kind of been waiting for that tweet, for that cell phone to go off, for that email to come in from a brigadier general saying, "Joe, I've got a story I think you're going to be interested in." It hasn't happened, not holding my breath, don't think it is going to happen, so I'm just moving on, just moving on. But you look at the white people who came out of the woodwork in the spring of 1879, Thomas Henry Tibbles, crusading journalist, began pounding out story after story after story, started out in Omaha, Daily Herald, Omaha Bee, jumped across the Missouri, got in Chicago, got in the papers of Boston, New York, Philly, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and pretty soon you have an East Coast citizenry that is electrified over the grotesque miscarriage of justice. They're petitioning their United States senators. These are abolitionists who have had the abolitionist fervor drained from them because the 14th Amendment had been passed quite a few years earlier, and they were looking for a new cause to hook that abolitionist fervor up to, and they found it in the stories of Thomas Henry Tibbles about this middle-aged chief from Omaha, Nebraska, and they wanted to help. And they started firing telegram after telegram, their U.S. senators, and Congress began to take a look at what was going on here. Bishop Clarkson, I'm guessing that's a name that resonates with at least two people in here, Well, there's one. Bishop Clarkson was infuriated over this story. The most powerful religious symbol in Nebraska in the spring of 1879 was writing telegram after telegram to the U.S. Secretary of the Interior saying simply, hey, I'm kind of paraphrasing here, hey, I want you to square for me how, on the one hand, we're supposed to Christianize these people, and on the other hand, we're supposed to send them to their certain death. Would somebody out there in Washington explain that? Explain how we close the gap between what seems like a dichotomy to me? He was furious. Didn't wait for a response. He started organizing food drives up and down the Eastern Corridor of Nebraska. Food for the Ponca, clothing for the Ponca, shelter for the Ponca. All the churches up and down this Eastern Corridor under the tent of Bishop Clarkson coughed up all kinds of supplies. The Jewish community of Omaha. The Jewish community of Omaha comes out into the streets and into the churches and into the greater society of Omaha and starts hitting up white people for defense donations for an American Indian. Now go back into the continuum of the 19th century and try and find another incident where the Jewish community is hitting up white people in defense of an American Indian. Don't do it. It's a waste of time because it didn't happen. It didn't happen. It happened once. It happened in Omaha in May of 1879. You have the general counsel of the Union Pacific Railroad. Again, of course his name would be Andrew Jackson Poppleton. Name you can't make up, a character you can't make up, and an irony that you can't make up. In the spring of 1879, Andrew Jackson Poppleton was the general counsel for the Union Pacific Railroad, the one institution in America that had probably done more to destroy Native culture than anything else. Andrew Jackson Poppleton, in the spring of 1879, was this silver-haired, silver-tongued orator, the first lawyer admitted to the bar in the history of Nebraska, a former state legislator, a former mayor of Omaha, and now the general counsel. He got wind of this story and could not let go of it. So he decides to represent Standing Bear pro bono for free. The judge never, go back and look at the decisions of his, the only federal judge in Nebraska, Elmer Dundee, in the spring of 1879. Go back and look at his decisions. Never wrote anything even remotely favorable to American Indians. But when this man sat on the witness stand in his courtroom and he listened to this story, something resonated within Judge Dundee. And if you read his 15-page decision, which I know at least one person in the room has done repeatedly, you will see that it's almost an emotional reaction and a human reaction codified in a legal opinion as much as it is a legal opinion. There is something about this man and something about how this face, which I don't understand, how this face, considering all that had been through, did not become a mask of bitterness, anger, and rage. I don't know how Standing Bear pulled that off. But there is something about this man that engaged all of these different levels of white society to step out of the shadows and not just indirectly fight on his behalf, but directly get involved in making sure that this man got justice through the American courts. So that's a second reason. Great constellation of universal themes, great constellation of white heroes. And I would say the third reason I like this story so much is not so much literal, but more metaphorical. The first two reasons, the themes and the number of white people came in, I can prove that. I can literally prove that those are true. The third one, I can't prove it's true, but I know it's true. And I think it's a metaphorical reason that I have for loving this story so much. And that metaphorical reason can be reduced to this principle. For 2 days, right across the street from where we are, this middle-aged chief, devoted husband and father, sat on the witness stand. And he was on the receiving end of this barrage of aggressive questioning from this young, brash federal prosecutor by the name of Genio Lamberson, who was in Standing Bear's face for the better part of 2 days, demanding to know, who are you? What does it mean to be a chief? Who are the Ponca? What do the Ponca believe in? What are your values? Who is your God? What does your God believe in? I mean, that's literally true in terms of the kind of aggressive, in-your-face questioning that Genio Lambertson was asking Standing Bear. But I think if you stand back far enough from this story, almost like a Matisse painting, if you're up too close, you can only see the dots. But if you just kind of step back, you can begin to see these dots making a pattern. And I'm saying, in my view of all the research I've done and all that I know about this story, that it really wasn't Standing Bear who was on the witness stand in the spring and the summer and the fall of 1879, that Standing Bear, in effect, had put America on the witness stand, and he was holding up a mirror to them, and he was asking the questions. He was the asking the questions of this young country that was beginning to flex its powerful economic, military, and social muscles in a way that would redefine the world order for decades to come. But in the spring, summer, and fall of 1879, this middle-aged chief of an obscure tribe in a remote corner of the Great Plains was putting the United States on the witness stand, and he was asking the questions. He was asking, no, you got it all wrong. Who are you? And what do you believe in? And what is this thing you call democracy? And who is your God? And what does your God believe in? And he was making America own up to that question, which had been swept under the carpet, out of sight, out of mind, for 103 years, but not in the spring, summer, and fall of 1879. That one question of who are these people? Who are these Indians? And where do they fit in to our system? Where do they belong? Should they be citizens? Should they die on the margins and go away? Standing Bear wasn't letting that question linger and fester under the carpet anymore. And that's one of the great aspects of this story. To me, any great story, whether it's told in text, in narrative book form, whether it's a play, whether it's an opera, whether it's a poem, any great story should force the recipient to do two things. To force the reader or the viewer to look deep inside themselves and ask at 3 o'clock in the morning, who am I? Who am I really? When all the masks, all the artifice are stripped away in the dead of night, who am I? And secondly, what is it that I believe in? What do I really believe in? And I think Standing Bear's story enables us to dig deeper into ourselves and forces us to dig deeper into ourselves. And it certainly did in the spring, summer, and fall of 1879. It forced an entire country to dig deeper and ask, who are we and what do we believe in? And I think if a story penetrates deep enough and it resonates with enough people who ask those questions and honestly answer them, that collectively we begin to see the world in more compassionate eyes. And you can't really ask much more out of a story or a painting or a poem or a play or an opera than that. So finally, in my opinion, if we were to create a table in this room and we called this a table of American history heroes, and we all handed out ballots, and we all got to vote, who would we want sitting at that table of American history heroes? And I'm guessing by the time I handed them out and collected them, that resolute rail splitter from Illinois would get a seat at the table. I'm fairly confident, after all the ballots had been counted, that celebrated kite flyer from Philadelphia would get a seat at that table. I'm pretty sure that the man who wrote those magnificent letters on freedom from his jail cell in Birmingham, Alabama, would get a seat at the table of American history heroes. I'm pretty sure that woman who decided not to give up her seat on the bus in Montgomery in December of 1955 would be seated at that table. And I'm just saying, for me personally, it would not shame me or embarrass me in any way, shape, or form if we as a country were to approach that table of American history heroes and we saw an empty chair with a brass plate right above that chair that said simply, "Reserved Chief Standing Bearer." Thank you very much.
Thank you. Gary Kerr will be gathering your questions, and I do compliment you for getting up every morning at 3 in the morning, because it turned conscience, that trial, conscience into courage, but it turned your passion into prose. Your words are beautiful. I've read the book, and it's a splendid book, not only factually, but the way it's written. So I compliment you, and I would certainly accept some questions. Question here. What were the national reasons the dominant culture used to substantiate their measuring for threatening humans this way? For treating humans this way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very complicated question. And rational, that's a key word in that question. Let me just answer it specifically and keep it apples and apples with Standing Bear. The reasoning of the government was actually very simple. They had spent untold manpower and decades and thousands of hours trying to sweep the Great Plains in the 1860s and 70s free of these rebellious tribes and to get them all bottled up. Primarily, the Indian Territory was set aside as a central clearinghouse to just sweep the western states clear of the Arapaho, the Cheyenne, the Sioux, the Pawnee, the Comanche, all the tribes of the West, just sweep those lands clean and move everybody to Oklahoma and just keep them there and open up all of these lands for white settlement. So they had expended a great deal of effort in doing that, time, lives, blood, lots of battles, and finally they were close to popping that cork into the bottle, getting all these tribes into the Indian Territory. And then suddenly, in the spring of 1879, this one tribe squirts out and does an end around and decides it wants to go home. Now, the last thing that the architects of Indian policy, and in the late 1870s, there was a tremendous struggle going on between who got to call the shots, the United States Army or the United States government. The Army had traditionally decided what the Indian policy was going to be, but it was starting to morph from the hands of the generals to the hands of the politicians. The last thing that either group wanted in the spring of 1879 was, after two decades of terrific firepower and work to get all these tribes into Oklahoma, was to have some renegade little tribe decide, "The hell with this, I want to go home." And they were looking at this as a dangerous, dangerous precedent-setting event that could wreak all kinds of havoc, with the Cheyenne wanting to go back to Montana, the Arapaho wanting to back to Wyoming, the Comanche wanting to go back to Texas. So they were very, very determined to make sure to use Standing Bear and these 29 stragglers as examples that, no, you don't try and leave the reservation, and here's what happens if you do, which makes it even better because you've got something to push off against. If you're telling a story, it's this middle-aged chief suing the United States government and the United States military, and he wins. It's similar to Dred Scott, only Standing Bear won. And the government was very, very concerned that this was just a precedent-setting event, and that was the rationale for a lot of the behavior that they used in trying to make sure that this didn't become an example, a bad example, to the dozens of other tribes that had been squeezed into this really hated place.
Did the judge's decision affect other tribes as well as other Indian people?
You guys ask good questions. They're not simple, which means it's a good question. This answer is tied to the first question. The government had a little bit, well, maybe a lot, of genius in deciding how it was going to react. This was the last thing they wanted. The last thing they wanted was some crackpot grizzly hunting judge in some place called Nebraska declaring that Indians are humans and have the same constitutional privileges as the more fortunate white race and can sue the government and win. That is like the nightmare scenario if you're William Tecumseh Sherman, or if you're the president, or if you're the head of the Senate. That is not what they wanted to hear. That's not what they wanted to hear. So what the government did in order to contain the damage of this decision, Standing Bear's lawyers, led by Andrew Jackson Poppleton and Thomas Henry Tibbles, the crusading newspaper reporter, they began to, once the decision, the favorable decision came in, they began to launch this enormous fund drive to try and gather as much money as they can, including an East Coast speaking tour, because they knew that the government was going to appeal this case and that it would likely go to the Supreme Court, and they wanted to amass a war chest in order to fund this at the Supreme Court level and make it the law of the land. What the government did that was very ingenious was it decided not to appeal the case, because the government was mortified that it would get to the Supreme Court and what had been a local decision would become a national decision, and then they were really screwed. Now this was purely viewed as damage control. The judge's decision was localized. It did not impact every single American in the country. It was tailored specifically to Standing Bear and these 29 people. And the government wisely, from their standpoint, began to listen to their lawyers, who said, let's just suck it up and eat this one and not push it and expand it beyond this one federal district in Nebraska. You would have a lot more to say on that, and it'll be in the brief.
There are two questions relating to this. What happened to Standing Bear after the trial, and did he return to the reservation, and was he allowed to bury his son?
Standing Bear was allowed to leave Omaha in May of 1879 as a free man, with now the bones of his son in his possession in a trunk that he kept. He and his immediate family, after giving presents, going to the homes of John Webster and Andrew Jackson Poppleton, giving Poppleton a war bonnet that had been in the family for generations, and giving John Lee Webster a tomahawk. Standing Bear laid it down at, this is the other lawyer, John Webster's feet, and said, "I need this no longer. I have found a better way," meaning the U.S. justice system. And then they got in the buckboard wagon, and they began going back, and Standing Bear did bury his son. Nobody knows where he's buried. Standing Bear rather quickly faded from the political scene after this East Coast speaking tour that lasted in the rest of 1879. But after that, this is a man who three times in his life walked the 550 miles between Nebraska, South Dakota, Oklahoma, and back. That's like walking from here to Los Angeles. And he was in his 50s when he did it. I mean, it's incalculable, the difference between the physical life then and the – I mean, I've driven that a bunch of times, and I got really exhausted with coffee and the Beatles' greatest hits. And, I mean, I was tired of the drive after 6 hours. He walked this three times in his 50s and early 60s, which is insane. he very quickly, after the fall speaking tour ended in December in New York City, he rather quickly just faded from the national scene. And he was, 10 years after the decision, he was given an allotment, his own land, on the west bank of the Niobrara River, and he lived in a beautiful farmhouse on the west bank of the Niobrara River with his family, and became a farmer, and died in September of 1908. And there was an article in the New York Times upon his death, and then he basically was written off the American history blackboard. But there are a number of us, including my good friend Christine Leshak at Nebraska Educational Television, who has done a magnificent documentary on Standing Bear called Standing Bear's Footsteps. It was shown in Nebraska last July. It's going to be released nationally in October. I just got back from New York 2 weeks ago and had a two-hour discussion with the program director for the National Museum of the American Indian, which is under the branch of the Smithsonian in New York City. If you ever get a chance, has anybody been to this museum? It is insane. You've been to it? Is it absolutely? The building, I mean, of all the places in the world that I've been, the most perfect place to have a major talk about Standing Bear. There's nothing better than this. This building is just, it's so gorgeous. You just are kind of in shock in the first 90 seconds you're there. So anyway, the program director heard the pitch and was just ecstatic. Yes, let's do a major talk about this man, and scheduled it right on the spot. 3 o'clock. Saturday, September 8th. So if you're in New York, and the UCLA game's not till 6:30, so there's plenty of time. So this magnificent story is just going to, the audience for it is going to keep expanding. And we are determined that somewhere in this can-do city, somewhere in this room, there is the person or persons who is going to make sure that sometime in the next couple of years, when there's another College World Series, when there's another swimming championship, that all these people walking around the old market are going to come to a corner and they're going to see a life-size bronze statue of yes, with a plaque that says 6 blocks west of here in the spring of 18. Where is that statue? You guys put up stadiums like in a week and a half. That stadium, that statue needs to be down in the old market somewhere. I mean, in my opinion, there's nothing of greater significance that has happened in Omaha more so than this. I mean, in terms of the reverberations, this is such a great thing that this city can be proud of because of how instrumental the city and its residents were in righting a wrong. That this has to be reduced to a nice life-size bronze statue that Harold and Maude from Oregon can nudge each other and say, hey, look at this. Are you kidding me? Just 6 blocks from La Buvette, a national civil rights figure emerged from the justice system. I didn't know that. Did you? No, that statue is a no-brainer.
There is a comment, because this was another important person in the trial. Would you please comment on Bright Eyes during and after the trial?
Well, whoever wrote that, thank you. Bright Eyes, I've not done her justice. I tried to in the book, but I haven't this afternoon. Major, major, major figure. Incredible. I mean, incredible. What she brought to the table and how this story, the trajectory of this story would have been dramatically altered and maybe not even existed if Bright Eyes hadn't been there to interpret Standing Bear's words, to give him comfort, to help out in this grueling East Coast speaking tour that went on ad nauseum week after week after week. She's a story unto herself. She's a book unto herself. This LaFleche family, again, Omaha Nation. This was maybe the most remarkable Indian family in the United States in the last quarter of the 19th century. There were four sisters, LaFleche sisters, daughters of Joseph LaFleche and his wives, and Bright Eyes was the oldest. Suzette LaFleche Tibbles was the oldest of the four sisters. And she was educated at a girls' school in Elizabeth, New Jersey, where in the 1860s she fell in love with Shakespeare and could quote entire page after page after page of A Midsummer's Night Dream and King Lear. Now, how many Indian women do you think there were in the 1860s who could quote six pages of King Lear? Incredible family. And she was just a remarkable, remarkable person who is a major player in all of this. Very frail, very hated speaking before crowds, shy, all of that. But a remarkable figure who kind of grew into her role by the time her life ended far too early at age 49. She had emerged as one of the preeminent national crusaders for not only Native rights, but Native American women's rights. And that's a whole nother category. That's a whole nother category. But she was an incredible force in this whole drama and is worthy of a book unto herself. And her younger sister, Susan, that's the book project I'm working on now. Her sister was born in an Animal High teepee in the waning weeks of the Civil War, July 17, 1865, 24 years later, graduated as the valedictorian of her medical school class at the University of Philadelphia Medical School and became the first Native American female doctor in the history of the country. Now, how did that happen? I'm guessing because she was competing against the daughters of all the Brahmins on the East Coast, I'm guessing that their eighth grade chemistry classes were a little more sophisticated than Susan's, and yet Susan was the one who graduated number one in her medical school class. Again, just an outrageous story. It's kind of the, in some ways, it's the on the other side of the gender highway from the Standing Bear story, which isn't a bad place to be.
Thank you. There are many additional parts to this story that you can read in his book. Thank you so much for your attentiveness. I especially thank Mr. Sterita for coming. This is his sixth talk in 8 days. The book was first published 3 years ago, this past January. And for an independent author in this manner, I think that having those talks continue so with such a steady pace 3 years later is a testimony to what the book is all about, not only the topic, but the way he presented it. Thank you, Mr. Sterita, for a beautiful afternoon.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Joe Sterita, a professor in the College of Journalism and Mass Communications at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, former New York bureau chief at the Miami Herald, and author of The Dull Knives of Pine Ridge, A Lakota Odyssey, and I Am a Man, Chief Standing Bear's Journey for Justice. He spoke on the topic, Chief Standing Bear of the Ponca Indian Tribe. This program is recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, June 21st, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be Thursday, July 19th at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speakers will be Harris Frankel, assistant professor in the Department of Neurological Sciences at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and president of the Nebraska Health Information Initiative, Incorporated, and Sean McGuire, founder of E.D. Bellis Healthcare Consulting. In a program called The Healthcare Reform, Obamacare, they will discuss the impact of the so-called Affordable Care Act. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.